All right. Welcome to the MacGuffin Men. I'm Alex, and with me, as usual, is James. You can check out our website, themacguffinmen.com, to keep up on our most recent podcasts. Our last three episodes have been on Bong Joon-ho's Memories of Murder, Jordan Peele's Us, and Charlie Kaufman's I'm Thinking of Ending Things. So yeah, you can check that out at themacguffinmen.com. I also wrote a book. It's a book of essays. The last essay is about the filmmaker we'll be talking about today. And yeah, you can get it on Amazon. It's called Content About Content. Or if you don't like to give Jeff Bezos money, you can just get in contact with me on Twitter at themacguffinmen, and I will just send it to you. All right, peace out. Okay, James. Now the exposition that Christopher Nolan hates is out of the way. It's time for more exposition explaining what we're doing here today. We are talking about Tenet, the new Christopher Nolan movie.
So new, hot off the
presses. Hot off the presses, depending on when you saw it. So like the thing I want to say up front about this movie is I am very confident my opinion on this movie 6 months from now or like a year from now is probably going to be slightly different from whatever we're recording here, because I think this movie was released in a totally unique situation that I don't really care to talk about. Like, I don't have any new points. I don't know if you do. If you wanted to address it, then I think we do it off the top. Or if you just want to skip right over it. I just think that, like, I think more than any movie in my life, I have been conscious of the experience of being in a movie theater to watch Tenet when I saw it, you know, like just being so aware of the environment it was released in and not necessarily being 100% on board with how it's being released or all these things. And I just think that that goes into everybody's first review of this movie, whether they're conscious of it or not. No matter how you feel, I think it's impossible to say that the circumstances don't affect how you're reviewing it. Like, you just read reviews of this movie and the opening is, we saw this in a clean theater. We do not recommend seeing this movie in the theater. You know what I mean? And yeah. So like, I just think like it's important to be upfront about the fact that it's just a totally weird time to be talking about a movie this weird. You know what I mean? And I just think like, I just want to couch everything I'm about to say with the fact that I might not feel this way a year from now, you know?
Yeah, no, I think that's right. And I have some kind of questions about its legacy and long-term reception that we can get to later. But yeah, I'll just point out that not just by us, but this was kind of one of the most highly anticipated movies ever in a very specific sense, you know, not the way that we always look forward to movies, but just in the sense that people wanted this to maybe save an industry that matters a lot to some people and matters a bit less to some people. So it was hotly anticipated in the sense that any Christopher Nolan movie is highly anticipated, and any movie that costs whatever, $205 million to make is going to be highly anticipated. But this one also comes with things that are much more macro than that, you know, things beyond us liking his previous movie, so wanting to see this. It just came with so much baggage that, yeah, I think I don't really need to say more about that, but I think you're right too.
Yeah, and the fact that he so firmly put himself personally as a part of the discussion, like putting out I think it was in the Washington Post op-ed in April. You know, he just sort of, as the most famous filmmaker alive, not named Spielberg, probably, you know, like, or George Lucas, I guess, maybe. You know, he really put himself into the argument, and that sort of just complicates things. But anyway,
yeah, let's talk. He's the last, like, he's the newest big director.
Oh, for sure.
You know, you could argue Scorsese and Spielberg and all those people have an undeniable merit, but just as someone that's kind of, he's you know, younger than them. He's not a young man, but just being of a much different generation, he's kind of one of the vanguards of modern filmmaking. So it's worthy that he put himself out there. And I'm not to say that I agree 100% with what he said or how he went about saying it, but yeah, that is worthy of mentioning too.
Exactly. He's the, if Spielberg is the Steven Spielberg of the movie brats, like the sort of 70s auteur group, Nolan is the Spielberg of the 90s movie brats, which is the Fincher, PTA, that whole cohort. Tarantino, he came along like at the tail end of that group, but still, you know, he is the guy who makes a lot of money from that group. So With that in mind, so I think I have basically two lists of notes. I can, one of which will make it sound like I like the movie slightly more than I do, and one that will make it sound like I like the movie slightly less than I do. Do you want to start with good or bad? And sort of like, well, you know, it's an emotional temporal pincer movement. Both sides are operating simultaneously, but I think like whichever side we choose first is going to dictate the conversation, basically.
Okay, well, let's start with the bad. I always think that's the wise way to do things.
Okay, so I have... basically, in my head, I have two movies that I can see this turning into in my mind over time. I can see, like, the good version of this is Blade Runner, right? Like, the first Blade Runner, where it's this sort of kind of boring protagonist. It's a perceived failure for reasons outside of its control. The movie is totally devoid of emotion. And it's a stylistic marvel that reveals itself as nerds like us continue to watch and rewatch it, right? Which, mm-hmm. if we were like 30 or whatever, when Blade Runner came out, we 100% would have been one of those people, right? And the other option for me, and this is sort of the side of the argument we're taking, is Miami Vice from 2006, where it is this unbelievable technical achievement, just filled with jargon. You don't care about a single person. The filmmaker, who is already famous, is cashing in on their previous success. And it's just this essentially like this perfect, gorgeous nonsense film with impenetrable characters and a million lines that are stupid and hilarious. And there's even tons of boat shit that I wish wasn't in the movie, just like Miami Vice, you know? So all it was missing was a Bacardi mojito. And that's sort of like, I think it's going to end up being one of those two movies. And I'm happy with both of those. Like, I am one of the bigger fans of Michael Mann's Miami Vice movie. That is a backhanded compliment, but it's still definitely more compliment than backhanded.
For the next 5 years, if anyone mentions they haven't seen one of those movies, you'll say, I will 100% watch this movie with you right now.
For the next 50 years. Like, I just, yeah. I can't even imagine. But even, like, Miami Vice has people that legitimately love it. And, I saw it playing in a movie theater within the last couple of years, and the row in front of me was middle-aged men who were legitimately emotionally attached to it. And the row behind me was college kids who were stoned and laughing at everything I was laughing at. So it's like, my gut tells me Tenet will end up being a Miami Vice, and then I'll just keep watching it a million times. But I guess that's sort of the lead into, what do you think about this movie? Where do you sort of fall on that? Long point I just made.
I can definitely see it going both of those ways, and it'll depend what what Nolan does with his rest of his career. I think will affect that too. Mm-hmm. And I think it's, and I would not be shocked if I said this about Inception, probably Interstellar, probably not Dunkirk, but this seems to be the most Nolan of the Nolan movies, and of course recency bias, but that's why I do think a lot about what we're going to think of it is going to depend on his career, because this might be the purest distillation of something we've decided we don't like as much as we're used to, and that won't bode well for it long term. Mm-hmm. If it's the purest distillation of something that we wish we had a bit more of, or you know, he kind of evolves a bit out of this period and you know makes things that are kind of different, then maybe it'll something we miss. But it's a lot, and I mean to come into it, it starts off like a good Christopher Nolan beginning. Like
the
I think
first
it
7 minutes of this movie is so good, you know. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it also just comes in hot, like a follow. Like it's just starts with no information, and that's part of the Miami Vice thing as well. The theatrical version of that just sort of comes in right in the middle of a club scene. But yeah, the opening is so good.
Yeah, and then all of the people falling asleep at the beginning of the opera is just a really good visual. Not knowing anything about these characters, I mean, knowing as much as you kind of end up knowing about the protagonist. Finally, a movie where you don't have to remember people's names, by the way.
I wish he had a name like Ariadne that I had to try really hard to remember. You know? Actually, Ariadne stuck in my head too, but...
Yeah, it's memorable for that. But no, it's just like that opening sequence, as I said, we'll talk more about the music, but I think the music grips you right away. Trying to keep up with who this person is, and just the different badges on the shoulders or epaulets or whatever they might be properly called. very cool. I'm sure it's been done before, but like just one of those little practical tricks that you can do. It just gets you that much more intrigued. You don't know what's going on, but you get the sense that the stakes are high. You know, there's guns and violence and explosives. But just for a sort of self-contained action piece where character motivations aren't made clear yet because it's the first scene, you don't know what everyone's up to or who they are, which, you kind of only get one scene where you can do all that, and it's not a shortcoming. And this is just such a very interestingly done scene. And this movie does have some stumbles and some bits of dialogue, and they're mostly absent from the beginning of this movie. It's unfortunately the Twilight world.
Yeah.
I wish that was in a different part of this movie so that this scene could be a bit crisper. Mm-hmm. But for it to come out this way and look as good as it does and move with that propulsion that you want out of your best action scenes, to put that in the body of work with the Dark Knight robbery scene, with the Bane scene, the airplane scene from Dark Knight Rises, he's done some good intros, and this is a I would say right up there with the best of them. Although I really do like the airplane Bane scene.
Oh, it's so good.
Once again, some poor choices of dialogue and performance, maybe. But yeah. Put all together, I think it's I think that's one of the best.
Yeah, no, I agree entirely, and I think the thing that makes that movie, or sorry, that scene, the opening scene of Tenet, so good is it's like we just know. Pretty like we're able to pick up in the 30 seconds of intro of the orchestra tuning up all this stuff that it's some sort of spy type thing. There's some sort of spy team. When we see those badges get handed out, we're like, okay, so these are people that are pretending to be somebody they're not. But
yeah,
clearly
there's high stakes military, but we also just very quickly get that level of subterfuge. Like there's the guys doing this thing, and then there's also an element within that or on top of that or trying to pass off as something else. So even before you even just saying, okay, it's an action scene, but there's a bit more to it. Like you're already trying to kind of piece things together.
Exactly. And like, it doesn't take much to be like, okay, they're going to get a guy who's on the inside, and you don't even need to really hear the dialogue to figure out what's happening. And then it's like, okay, he's got to get the package, and then he's got to switch the person. Like, you don't need to know the why for any of this because you've seen enough spy movies to understand implicitly what's happening. And the shot where we see John David Washington for the first time, it's a very obvious setup that this is the guy we're following, as he's sort of doing bullet tricks by himself in the back of the van. But those are all things that we don't need to have new thoughts about because they're also deeply ingrained in us. And then you sort of get that one backwards bullet, and that's sort of like the new element. But the sequence other than that is just very easy to grab onto when just knowing what we know about action movies, and that's wonderful. And I love it, and I think something that is cool to be pointed out about this and other action sequences in this movie is that like it's not as big as most action sequences are in action movies of this caliber. Like it's as far as stunts and all of that stuff, it's mostly just people running around and squibs, or not even squibs, like just small explosives and gunshots. And it's there's something about it, about the intensity of it that makes it feel bigger than it actually is, or the actual number of parts that are a part of it. And I just think that's really cool and worth pointing out. Like it's
definitely upped just by, having this Kiev Opera House that's where it's set within the narrative, at least. It's just this beautiful building and thousands of people, it's not, as you said, it's this super highly choreographed thing with 200 stunt people pulling off these things that we could never do. It's people running up and down stairs, but shot compellingly, shot interestingly, a beautiful set, enough people. And I don't know, I mean, how many times we needs to be mentioned, but all these practical effects that even if you and I don't have the sharpest eye for pyrotechnics and CGI, yours admittedly a lot better than mine for a lot of that visual stuff, but it's all those things that there's just not that thing we can't quite place how how it's disengaging us, but it is disengaging us. You know, it all just looks like how we would imagine these things look without any of that uncanny valley, without, you know, those rubbery looks that CGI'd humans can get. You know, it's just, I think his insistence on doing things in camera and doing things practically, we've talked about this on other things, but even when you can't place what it is that's separating you, you do just get that detachment. And I don't feel detached during the first 7 minutes of this movie.
No, not at all. And I think part of the thing that makes it cool, to go on to your point, is like just shooting a bit wider, you know, like a wider angle. Mm-hmm. And especially, I think one of my favorite shots in this movie is the moment in the intro where I'm always going to call him John David Washington. I can't bring myself to call him by his name. When he's running to get the, what I will also call the package, because I hate what they call it, in the coat check, where he's just like sprinting towards the coat check and slides under some sort of table or whatever. But like, since the shot is so wide, and this is true of pretty much every shot where he's running, but this is like the real stunt, he's running really fast, and you can tell that he is fast, you know, like just visually. Yeah. It's like you're just watching a human being run fast, which I know sounds very simple, but with everything else that's going on outside of that shot, that surrounds it, it's just like, that's something that's cool. And there's a lot of really wide framed stuff in action sequences that just, there's something about it that makes it feel really grand. Just seeing a human being move the way that he does, specifically on that slide, you know, and also just as a general modus operandi for doing these action sequences, they really do lean on the wide shot whenever they can, as opposed to close up to dictate how we're supposed to feel, you know, this sort of Spielberg gaze thing.
Yeah, and since, I don't know, Jeff Goldblum, most of our action stars are extremely jacked now, but he's one. John David Washington is someone who is like properly athletic, even by action star standards.
Yeah, I mean, he played in NFL Europe, right?
Yeah, just a very successful college athlete, things like that. Yeah, and so that scene, I think really grips you. And then even the next scene in the rail yard, which are, you know, are kind of connected to me, you know, one's the direct cause of the other one, when he's being tortured and takes a cyanide pill. I think all that's good. And I love that he's already, I mean, just the sense that you get of this character who has already committed suicide for the greater good eventually, is a good shortcut and a good starting point to say, you probably thought the stakes were pretty high when this was just life and death for this man and all these people in the opera, presumably, but we're telling a bigger story than that. And you can argue about whether this story is successful in zooming out and making the scope a bigger than just a spy thriller or something like that. But I do think that up until that point, I think it functions, you know, as well as you can open up an action movie, essentially.
Oh, yeah. I think even through the, basically until he meets the scientist and says an obscure tenet at a level that is impossible to hear, even though I saw it five times in theaters, I never knew what he was saying. But like, basically until that point, I think this movie's more or less perfect, you know, like it's awesome. And then it's sort of just, certain things fall off the rails. And I think now's a time where, honestly, like one of the, I think you could tell me that if somebody made the argument to me that like, if this movie is well cast, it is your favorite Christopher Nolan movie, I would be like, yeah, sure, I buy it. You know, like,
is that the problem here?
I think it's a big problem. I think so. I mean, I do not like John David Washington in this movie very much. I think there's sort of just a, I know the point is that he's a quote unquote fresh faced protagonist and sort of like a blank canvas of for an action star, but it's just, there's something, it's just not there for me. I just don't care about him. And where you look at other Nolan movies, his leads, even like Leo, is somebody I'm not a fan of, right? But you just have some sort of pre-existing relationship with that human being. So you care about that person, right? Throughout Inception, right, in some capacity. And I know my gut tells me that Nolan was specifically trying to get away from that because this is his first, coming off of Dunkirk, where he successfully, I think, sort of built a movie around a character who may or may not have even had a name. I don't remember. It was probably Jack, right? And but he didn't speak much. But the difference between something like that and the protagonist is that it's a lot easier for us to imagine World War II, you know, than it is to imagine going through what the protagonist is going through. And the other thing is he's wearing a mask for half the goddamn movie. So, like, we just don't even have, like, a human being to identify with for a lot of it, right? So if you don't care about the human being, and then you're covering up most of the face, and you're telling us that this is a quote-unquote ride that we need to stop trying to understand and just feel it, like, there needs to be something that we're grabbing onto. And I know the idea is that we're supposed to follow the protagonist, and that's what we do for the whole movie, but, like, it just, if you don't care about anybody on the journey, then, or you don't care about the person leading you through the journey, it's just hard to get involved with the movie, right?
And yeah, no, I think Dunkirk's an interesting one, because I think that we have so little information about those characters, you know, even just outside of, you know, I remember us talking about it. I think that first sequence where the leaflets are falling from the sky, mm-hmm. and we'll say the protagonist has to, you know, take cover, and you think that, oh, probably there'll be a scene eventually where we learn about this guy's mom back home or his other brother in the war or whatever, and it never happens. Mm-hmm. It doesn't happen to anybody really in that movie, and that movie just sort of, you know, its cash value is that sense of dread and you kind of putting yourself in that position, and so it doesn't access the same emotions that I think a lot of narrative storytelling does. But I think, you know, listen to that episode, we both kind of thought that experiment worked, mm-hmm. and it was pretty successful. This movie does seem to have an interest in emotion, and I think it just whiffs on a lot of the big swings it takes. Like, we are meant to believe that the protagonist has some feelings for Kat and that there's a life to be thought about and considered there, mm-hmm. and I just think it does not click at all. Like, I just don't think it. I think that they want something to be there that's not there, whereas I think in Dunkirk they're a bit more abstract, these feelings of dread, as I said, and you know, trying to picture yourself in this position. And I think that's a different set of goals than Tenet is trying to achieve. And I think those goals are where Tenet misses the mark, like, almost entirely, in my opinion.
Yes, I agree with that as well. And Elizabeth Debicki is the other side of this charisma free coin. I think if you cared about one of those two actors, you know, I don't even think that Nolan has to get it right on both. I think if you just care about one of them, then this movie, it just carries the movie. Like, there's that moment where it's right before the protagonist meets Sator, who we will move on to momentarily. he and it's him and Kat standing on a cliff or something. And there's this really nice piece of music playing behind them, and they're having this conversation, and it's like, and I remember thinking, watching this movie the most recent time, and just being like, this is a good scene that purely doesn't work because of the actors, you know, like, and it's just
beautiful location,
incredible cinematography. And again, the music is very beautiful and mournful, and we'll get to how much I love the music in this movie, but it just, it, like, the only thing I can point to for this, I mean, it's still Nolan dialogue, so it's stilted, but I've seen dialogue as stilted as that work before in Nolan movies. And I guess maybe it's the difference between Matthew McConaughey crying and watching a video of his kid on Earth, or Anne Hathaway crying and talking about how love transcends dimensions, although that's pretty terrible too. But there's just an element of it being sold that just doesn't work in this movie. And it's interesting because I did really like John David Washington in Black Klansman, and I just wonder if he was just perfectly cast in the Spike Lee movie, you know?
So yeah, no, I know, and you said this to me a while ago, but his father is one of the most charismatic people going. Uh-huh. I'm not gonna
absolutely
take anything away from Denzel being a extremely likable, like, even when he's the, you know, the cocky person who you, I don't know, I'm thinking of Taking Impel 1-2-3. Unstoppable.
Unstoppable, yeah.
You know, he could still come in and be like kind of rude and kind of giving your other character a hard time that you seem to be meant to be aligned with more, but he's just so undeniably enjoyable and charismatic that it totally skips that part of your cognitive dissonance. Like, yeah, you're just okay with this guy because exactly, he's so funny and cool.
Yep.
And you know, maybe John David Washington is capable of that, and maybe it's something he brought to this role, or Nolan didn't want to see that again. Mm-hmm. Because I don't know, I have a hard time saying that it's just him not being likable and charismatic enough.
He
has that in his wheelhouse, but Nolan's just telling such a different story.
You're right, you're right, the movie does him no favors with the way that his character is written, and the fact that he's supposed to, he's specifically designed as a character we know nothing about, and the movie doesn't want us to know anything about him other than what it physically shows us. And so, yeah, the movie does him no favors. His scene partner in a number of his scenes does him no favors, and vice versa. I just think it's just a miss. And something that that I come back to with this is, I was listening to an interview where Christopher Nolan talked about how Kenneth Branagh, who plays Sater, wanted to sort of inject a little bit more personality to his character, like humanity in some capacity, and Nolan swayed him away from it. And I was like, okay, so that's my problem with this movie, is that when people tried to be human beings, Nolan said no. And he said, no, thank you. And I wonder if there are similar conversations with Elizabeth Debicki and John David Washington. And I just haven't found the information about it. But
I don't know specifically about like the Debicki performance, but in reading the interviews that I've read, I think she's 6'3", which she's this very like statuesque, you know, beautiful woman. And I think that they really wanted her to be a, you know, a pretty quiet character from the 40s is totally the way that I see this. Like, and that's the thing, there's amazing female performances in Hitchcock movies. So I can't just say that blanket statement and kind of sweep it all away, but it does seem like they wanted her to kind of have this unapproachable kind of air to her. And even the way they cut her costumes and stuff, they wanted her to be like this 30s, 40s, very...
She's wearing like wool bodysuits for parts of the movie. Or wool, like, I don't even know how to describe them. That's why I'm saying bodysuits.
Yeah, but I just think it was meant to be someone with this, you know, inner turmoil that's inaccessible. And I just think it comes off as cold and not a great performance, and I just don't know enough about her career to say she's not capable of that, because that's not fair. But it does just seem like they wanted her to be at a distance and wanted her to really be not a 2020 human being woman.
I mean, it's not like there's a long history of Christopher Nolan writing women characters that make sense, or just human characters that make sense, you know.
No,
like,
I'm well aware of all of that, and was well aware of it going into that. And this didn't seem like it was something he wanted to shake. Like, I bet he's heard all of these criticisms more times than we've thought about them. But it didn't seem like he wanted to give this woman, this, like, you know, cat. They didn't want her to be someone that you've ever met or talked to, and kind of a more of a femme fatale is not quite the word, but just to evoke that sense of a noir woman who is not a Earth woman, you know what I mean? That did not seem to be part of the calculus at all. So I don't know. I say all this to say I don't know if I can just say it's not a good Debicki performance, or if it's an amazing Debicki performance in the sense she's doing what she was tasked with.
And I
just don't love the task, and it sounds like you don't either.
No, I agreed, and I do like her in Widows, the Steve McQueen movie, but I haven't liked her in anything else. So it's not like there's, I guess it's the same with John David Washington. I like him in one other thing, you know? And it's just not directed by Nolan, but, okay. So what you're saying about him not wanting Kat to be a 2020 woman. Yes, but I also, so my concern is that he thinks that this movie is a feminist text. You know, like that's sort of the way that I come with it, not just because of her, but because of Priya. And I think he thinks that purely by injecting like one woman in control at some point in this movie, he now thinks that he has solved all of his issues with female characters, and we don't need to relitigate everything. But like that's the feeling I get watching Tenet, watching Cat, and watching the scenes with Priya, is that I think Nolan thinks he is righting some wrongs in his past movies with these specific characters. And I think we both come down on decidedly on the side of no, you know?
Yeah. And that might be true of some criticisms he's had about people of color as well.
Yeah.
And to your point about Priya, there is the red herring of, we assume that it's the husband, you know, there is that,
yep, of course,
understanding that they go in there and expecting it to be the man who's the arms dealer, or you know, whatever that role is specifically. Yep. And you know, him sort of sidestepping it and giving it to Priya and giving her some other scenes where she's you know, she's obviously a very strong, accomplished, powerful woman in this movie. That's not to be questioned.
Yeah, for sure. And we haven't talked about Robert Pattinson in this movie, who I certainly like. I bet you do as well. Everybody does. But him and John David Washington seem to be pretty good on screen together, you know? And I think that's sort of where I'm coming back to with the sort of like that scene where if one of these actors was properly cast, the scene would be good. I think that's kind of what sort of solidifies that thought for me, in that the scene where Neil and the protagonist meet, that's like the only good human moment in the movie, you know, like, and it's really good. Like, and it's, they feel like human beings, and I like that scene a lot. But and I think it's just, they're well suited for each other, which just weirdly, this movie is full of combinations that are people who are not well suited for each other, seemingly, you know, on screen.
Yeah, no, I get that too. And I get that from reading a lot of people's reaction to it. It's, I don't know, simultaneously, it's, once again, Nolan doesn't understand how humans work, but look at these two guys just kind of having charm Olympics that, yeah, we all win, including them.
Yeah, for sure.
It does seem that it goes a bit both ways, but yes, I give my seal of approval to Robert Pattinson in this movie.
Yeah.
doing a Christopher Nolan / Christopher Hitchens in 2020 impression. Be still my beating heart.
Yeah, yeah.
But no, and just undeniably fun and funny. And we always talk about Nolan inserting himself into films in certain ways.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is a good one of him putting himself in as Robert Pattinson, which is a fantastic move.
Yeah.
just an extremely charming, attractive man.
Yeah. He's moved on from Leonardo DiCaprio to Robert Pattinson.
Yeah, exactly.
In this biopic he's making about himself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And yeah, I think he's quite good. And again, without what I assume is a lot of good stuff on paper, and a lot of, like, he's got a couple gimme putts of things that are,
oh,
are just fun and hard to screw up if you're a extremely attractive A-list celebrity. But no, I think he's good in this. And then we kind of flew past Sator / Kenneth Branagh.
Mm-hmm.
He's performing in this movie, yeah, as well. He is performing.
So I think one of my main issues with this movie is that, like, I'm not a huge Bond movie guy. And like, because he's, Sator's just an absolute Bond villain. Like, my motivation is I hate everybody, you know, and there's nothing more than that. And Nolan's movies and his villains specifically are a success when the lead is also the villain, you know, like when the real villain is yourself, you know, it's sort of an inner struggle thing. Like, all of Nolan's like really good movies are about inner struggles, at least partially. And that this movie is just totally has removed that aspect of it. And I find most Bond villains boring because of that. And Nolan loves Bond movies, and it's been apparent all throughout his career, but especially in this one, which is just a David Lynch Bond movie, you know?
Yeah, there is no, I mean, find me a character arc of anybody in this movie.
Agreed, 100%.
Like there's no interiority to anybody, even Kat, who has her son as an emotional sort of fulcrum for why she wants to do the things she does and why she can't act 100% in her best interest. You know, mm-hmm. why she doesn't just leave Sador or kill herself or, you know, the other horrible choices you have of getting out of a bad relationship. Yeah, I think, and I touched on this a bit earlier, but it does seem like this movie does want to have it both ways, where it's like, this is a movie that, you know, and the best summation of it is just don't think, just feel, while also like dumping expositional dialogue,
yeah,
and not having humans you can feel anything for. it does,
do what like, I want you to. You get no say in this matter. You know, that's what yeah, Aaron's doing basically.
Yeah, like I really do think, and I have a list of things that I really like about this movie too. But that
yeah, we're
to
getting
me
there.
Does
we're working.
I know that's true.
You chose this path.
I know. Yeah, this is the way. That does seem to be the purest distillation, I think, of what this movie is doing and failing to do, is saying, you know, let's make an extremely convoluted, science-heavy movie that's all about super vague emotions and like stilted theater acting from the 30s, and you're like, okay, well, those things are simply incompatible, and I can't give them both. And I love, and you and I both love, some good genre bending, and when, you know, when you don't know exactly what you're getting into and things bleeding into another, different kinds of storytelling and different kinds of art form, it just doesn't seem to do them both well.
No, I agree. And to, so I think the best way to, I mean, when we saw this movie together and the scientist says, don't try to understand it, feel it, I laughed out loud, you know, like 25 minutes into the movie. And so like the thing that, like, I agree with what you're saying, the whole exposition thing with me is like, you compare it to, the easiest comparison point is Inception, right? And the structure of Inception is basically like the MVP of that movie, in that you get this really cool opening action sequence, which Nolan is known for, and and then you get a long portion of the movie where you're explaining the rules, and then the whole second half of the movie is just those rules that you have spent a what is quite honestly like at times boring amount of time listening to Elliot Page explain it. The whole second half of the movie is just, okay, these are the rules and we're just following the ride. Like, that's how you can follow the ride, where you say, when you in this movie say, don't try to understand it, feel it, Tenet, the structure is cool action sequence, and then here are some rules, and then cool action sequence using those rules, and then here are way more rules, and they're going to change halfway through the action sequence. And like, if we aren't supposed to care about this dialogue or try to understand it, why is it in the movie? And it just, it's like, it has to have some meaning, you know. And I go back to Nolan's theory on not having a second unit, which basically, on most big movies, you have a second unit to shoot action sequences or parts of action sequences, or like establishing shots and all these things. And his argument for not using this is like, if I'm not there when it's being shot, why is it in my movie? If you're writing the words, why are people saying them if we don't need to understand, you know?
Yeah, and that's sound design, right? You mean?
No, that's also exposition. It's certainly partially sound design as well. I've definitely used that exact argument for sound design reasons, yeah. but exposition and sound design certainly line up with the dialogue that we can't hear. Like, don't have characters say it if it's not something we're supposed to hear, you know?
Yeah, and so I've been of sort of two minds of this lately, because I think about what I want, you know, as I said, what I just said about, you know, it trying to do these two things and not really landing, you know, sticking the landing on either one of them. So in my head, every time in thinking of this movie over the last little while, every time I think of something, instead of just being, you know, negative and criticizing, I think, okay, what would have made me happier? And if they did less exposition and really leaned into the you know, feel it thing. And it was a bit more of a, this might be putting it too lofty, but like a bit more abstract, like surreal, mm-hmm. almost like Dadaist. Like, you're not going to hear about entropy and chemical changes. Like, well, let's really just give you the ticket, ride the ride. Like, it's going to be confusing, and there's not going to be a point where you're like, oh, I wish Neil deGrasse Tyson was here explaining all this. Like, if you know, if it was truly just like, there's some fucked up time travel, yeah. and you know, would I be happier with that? Or, you know, take it the other way, like, what if I really, really could tell you everything at every moment about how the plot works? Like, I have a pretty good grasp on it, having seen it multiple times and, you know, read, and I don't care to have all the diagrams, but you know what I mean? Like, generally I can give you a summary that's correct, like, for, I don't know, 85% of this movie. Yeah. Definitely not 100.
I mean, that's bad. I don't know that I could get to 85%. Yeah. But I've seen this movie like 8 times. And we'll watch it at least 80 more, you know, like all this shit we're saying, this movie's still awesome.
Yeah, no, I know. And I'm just thinking as someone who would like, you know, in trying to figure out what actually would have made me happy, I truly don't know which way I'd rather it lean. Mm-hmm.
I know, and I would lean into that sort of Dada version that you yeah. outlined.
See, the idea of you not accepting a character that doesn't have a name, I think, speaks to the fact that might be a hole. But maybe you just don't want him to say protagonist as many times as he says protagonist.
You can call him the protagonist. Don't have characters say that word out loud multiple times, you know? Like, ugh. Mm-hmm. So bad. Somebody should have texted him that in the future or whatever his crazy technological shit is.
Can I ask you, just because we talked about Bond, I don't know that we'll circle back to it otherwise. What if this was a Bond movie?
Well, okay, so nobody wants fan theories. My assumption is that this movie was greenlit with the idea that this will not be the only Tenet movie. Whether or not Christopher Nolan is directing the next one, or if he's just sort of starting a Bond franchise and handing it off, I think this movie was, I think this movie was designed to have sequels.
And now we can have a bit more fun in this world if we've laid a lot of this groundwork.
Oh, one of my notes for this movie is all caps. God, I hope he makes a sequel to this movie, because I think he'll get
really?
It right next time. Yeah.
Man.
And it's purely because there's just, like, especially with something like this, where it's the first time he's done something like this with all the forwards and backwards stuff, you know, he's in the editing room thinking of things he wishes he did. And, like, I don't think that's always a good idea, but when the movie is as weird and complex and action-packed as Tenet, and the person who makes it is coming up with new versions, or new versions of these action sequences, I want to see them all. Like,
yeah,
backwards
yeah,
people, you cannot give me enough of it. Like, if his career is all sequels to this movie that, like, I think is middle of the road compared to most of his filmography, I'm fine with it. You know?
Oh, that's surprising. Yeah, but I do know what you mean when the protagonist goes through and is properly inverted and is even just stepping in the puddle for the first time, mm-hmm. you're like, oh, this is what all this was for. Yeah. Like, this is someone stepping in a puddle is now super fascinating. This, okay, I get why we did all of that.
Yeah.
Front heavy stuff. And as we said, the intro's, you know, not a chore. It's not as though there's nothing of value in the first half, because that's absolutely not the case in my opinion. Mm-hmm. But you do get that sense of like, okay, this was actually just a super big idea. And now that we've laid all this foundation, let's actually play in this world.
Exactly. So, like, Tenet to me feels like the whole movie, it feels like set pieces that are then connected by ideas. Like, he had the action sequences in his mind and then he wrote the movie around them. And, like, the always with the idea of the time inversion thing, but, like, that the action sequences came first, you know? And, like, that boat, that scene where they're on the boat, you know, or they're
which
doing,
one?
Yeah, sorry. I mean, like, the sailing action sequence where they're having a conversation while doing high speed sailing. And it's just, it's not even like well shot. There are a couple of shots in there that are like really sloppy. And
I kind of thought that too, to be honest.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think I am probably 200 times more interested in high speed sailboating than you are.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm not even interested in high speed sailboating, yeah. But you know what I mean. Like, it's I have time for that, mm-hmm. in a movie like this, mm-hmm. Or just like shots of the Amalfi Coast or whatever. Like, I 100% sign me up. I'm okay with all of this.
Yeah.
But that chunk is pretty awkward.
Yeah, it's real bad. And there's just one specific shot. I don't remember what the action is happening, but it's like the human body that we're listening to speak. I think it's Kenneth Branagh. We're only seeing his shoulder, but the shot is on screen for like a second. It's very bizarre. And they're like, I just can't even imagine the conversations that happened in the edit room about that shot. But so the other thing that I thought about this movie, well, the set pieces connected by ideas thing, I think that sort of leads into the idea that I would like to see a sequel or somebody playing in this world again, is just the idea that now that you sort of have these rules, now you know what you're working with when you can sort of actually maybe start with story next time as opposed to action sequences. And right. Again, this is purely hypothesizing on my part, but sorry, I'm a little asthma baby over here. But the other thing that I just can't work around for this movie is that the core idea of this movie seems to be like correcting the sins of the father, right? Like changing things so future generations live in a better world. And like, we both saw Looper and we both like Looper a lot. And Looper is about the same thing done in a more cohesively sort of thoughtful way. And that's something that I really couldn't. I've had a hard time working around since I saw Tenet for the first time, because when the end credits were rolling, I was thinking, oh, so it's Looper, you know, like, and that was just sort of, that's been tough for me to work around. But
like, in the sense that you've had the same theme delivered in a more interesting way.
Exactly. And none of the new stuff is more interesting. Like, cause Nolan really pours on the class stuff in this movie, and he's always sort of had class elements in his movies, but the louder they are, the worse it is. And this is as loud as they've ever been. And
Dark Knight Rises, I think, is probably the closest counter.
Yeah, that's second place for central. Sure. That's second place for sure. Because that, yeah, let's not relitigate that. But but like, class just runs all throughout his movies, even when you're not even realizing it, right? Like, even The Prestige is a story, a tale of class. And it's just so over the top in this movie. And I think the more obviously he pours it on, the worse it is. And, you know, it's like, Kaysader's a billionaire. We're talking about suits. And it just sort of feels really confusing hearing all that stuff come from a member of the 1% of the 1%, you know? And yeah. Certainly the artistic 1% of the 1%, you know? Like, there is nobody higher in the food chain of actual good talented directors than Christopher Nolan, you know, and it's just always, that's tough for me to work around. Yeah.
Yeah, no. And I agree in doing kind of a more forgiving reading of the Cat Sator relationship, which, you know, it sounds like we're largely on the same page. It just doesn't resonate. No. Like, you have DeBecky being kind of a glacier and separate, again, maybe not as a criticism of her abilities, but just the way that it ends up on screen. And then Sator, just to borrow a phrase, honey baked ham, just chewing the scenery, like just going for it. You know, I look at that.
I kept waiting for him to announce himself as a member of Spectre, you know? It's just no. So Bond.
Oh, but even louder than that.
Yeah.
You don't get that for a character wall to wall. And just, if we're on the subject.
Yeah, let's go for it.
Yeah, the one.
Hop on my sailboat. Let's yeah. talk this out.
It's not the first time, but so he's our big bad. When we cut to him pretty early in our exposure to him, and he's just scrolling through his phone wearing like athleisure wear on his yacht.
Yeah.
Oh, what a miss. Like, just. And I get it. That's probably something that character would do. I understand. But as we said, this movie kind of takes this stylized approach to things in a lot of senses. And that one just, I just can't put that in a neat little box of why that had to be the way that is. And I'm not bemoaning Kenneth Branagh as an actor or director or creative person. It just, the way that it ends up on screen, it just does not work for me at all, and that seems to be a big one. And so, as I was saying about those two, like I starting to look at that story and trying to think, okay, what's the story doing about wealth inequality? You know, Sater kind of more in isolation. What's the saying about wealth inequality? This guy is so rich. And this is one of the things that I do like, and I think would sync it up nicely with the Bond story, but him being young in the USSR and these men who are able to take this situation and, you know, born into an awful circumstance and look at the planet in a very self-minded way and try to make something of themselves, and the way that ties in with the Cold War and World War III, which are touch points throughout this movie. I think that there's a ton of stuff there. I think that there are nuggets to be mined, absolutely. A bunch of this stuff really lines up. But, you know, as I said, it never coalesces into the thing that I want it to be.
Yeah.
But yeah, looking at that story, what's the saying about, you know, men in power? We've got this very, obviously, physically and emotionally abusive person. Mm-hmm. And, you know, not all women are hemmed into emotionally abusive relationships by an art forgery plot that we haven't touched on yet.
Yeah.
But there is, you know, I was just trying to look at it in a positive way. I mean, positive is a, you know, in a forgiving sort of way. Like, what heavy lifting is he doing here? Is he giving these women a chance? Is he talking about these issues in a way that you can take something of value? You know, even if you can throw out all the rest of this movie, is something being done here that has emotional value or has some real world significance? And I just never think it quite clicks. Like, I just don't think it ever gets to that register. Mm-hmm. You can look at it through that lens and take bits and pieces, but and that's not, you know, what you need action movies for, but it did seem like there was something right there that never, you know, if we're going to talk about that character as someone who you have a hard time cueing into the emotional relevance, it does seem like there's something right there. It does seem like there's something within the grasp, and it never really materializes, at least to me, in a meaningful way.
No, I agree wholeheartedly. And so, oh, the other thing is the Freeport guy who is talking about how the only priority we have is your possessions or whatever he's saying, and Robert Pattinson's response is blimey. I was like, okay, so Christopher Nolan, you know about a place like this because you're storing art in it, right? Like, that's how you learned about this. That's how you came up with this idea, probably. But so the one last thing that I want to say that I have in my negative pile, sorry.
Okay, I have positive things to say about Freeport.
Oh,
so
we're
going to
talk about the Freeport. Don't worry.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay,
that's
okay.
Coming up.
Okay, then do what you're doing.
So we've talked about this on a number of action movies, right? And it's that I think the worst action in this movie is the last 3 minutes of action. And like, it all ties into the fact that we don't really care about, or certainly from my perspective, I had a hard time caring about the protagonist. I had a hard time seeing his face in that sequence.
Understanding his words.
I didn't really care about his voice. Yeah, exactly. I didn't really care about Kat and Sater on the boat. And so what you get is what follows, like the beginning part with all the army people moving in two separate timelines or moving forwards and backwards. All that stuff is obviously awesome. And then you just get like this long conversation in a cave and the other side of that conversation on a boat where two action sequences are happening concurrently that I don't really care about. And that moment where they get pulled out of that hole, like the last beat of proper action in this movie, that's like a cool thing. And if I cared about any character involved in it, it would be like it would at least be a good ending. But like when you're making an action movie and the worst moment of action is your last moment of action, I don't think we can overstate how much that hurts the whole picture.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. So that I agree with you when they're getting pulled out of that hole. That is kind of cool. And when you get that shot in the rear view of them coming up, that's interesting and, you know, visually pretty engaging. But if we're sort of coming up to the tail end of the things we didn't love about this movie, that the sequence of the three of them when they have, you know, the algorithm cubes,
the ugly standoff with the algorithm.
I wish that's what it was.
That I guarantee you that is what inspired that scene. I guarantee you.
I agree. Yeah. Like visually, I get that. We're missing all of the things that made that cool.
I mean, there is really good music in this scene. It's just, or in that movie, or in this movie, just not in that scene. There's the Ecstasy of Gold.
That's true. And we have the man with no name kind of stuff. Like, it's not such a stretch. But to me, like, the thing that I think people are going to remember, or I would imagine, about Christopher Nolan movies and his career, especially during this era, who knows what happens next, but he's going to be held up against what happened with the superhero genre, as a genre he has a lot to do with, by the way. Like,
yeah,
his hand in Batman has a lot to do with the way, maybe not that those stories are told, but that those movies are believed in, and that we can give $200 million to someone. And he wasn't the late era Marvel brain trust. Let's make sure we give everybody a line and set up the Netflix series and all that kind of stuff. But he can't be completely separated from that.
No, it's The Dark Knight and Iron Man being released in the same summer and both being huge successes. So you get the idea that we're starting a universe being a huge success, and then you get sort of this textbook example of the best possible way to do a superhero movie, you know. And then it's just every movie is a combination of those two things.
Yeah, and so that scene of the three of them, and they've got this object that, I don't know, I didn't even see Endgame, but the Infinity Stones, I think, is hard to not think of at that point in that movie. Mm-hmm. And I think what people are going to, or the way that even, not even just people, the way that you and I like to think about Christopher Nolan is that in this era of filmmaking, when everything was CGI and nothing had stakes, he did the opposite. You know, he did practical effects, and instead of a whole island or planet exploding and it kind of meaning nothing because it was just, you know, plot point B5 in whatever movie you put together, whatever script you and 30 other writers and, you know, the brain trust to put together, it doesn't matter. And so we liked Christopher Nolan for doing not that. And to me, that part of it is like, they're in Strask 12, they're in which sounds like a Star Wars planet, by the way. that whole action scene, the temporal pincer movement, they're killing people, and like, who are those people? Who what are their names? Who's paying them? What's their motivation?
They're the future. Somebody texted them.
Yeah, sure. Exactly, right? Like, all of those things that I think we rightly value about most of Christopher Nolan's career are out the window for large chunks of this movie. And even in Inception, which, you know, we both really like, he's sort of carved out these places that are these limbo worlds where they're either mercenaries or figments of someone's imagination, but they have guns and they're bad. You know, like, I do think that in that moment of this movie, we get the version of Christopher Nolan that completely undoes all the things that we like about him. Mm-hmm. And this, you know, Aaron Taylor Johnson character, you know, literally holding the stick with these cubes on it. And you're like, yeah, go all over time and hide these kinds of things. Mm-hmm. To me, that's such a repudiation of the things that we kind of know and like about him. And coupled with all the things that we say about, you know, we like it with characters that we know things about and who have these internal struggles and some sense of who they are with inside themselves. We don't get any of that goodness here. And it's something that's sort of just like lost and wrapped in the plot device of time inversion. And it's more high-minded because it's not time travel like Avengers or something.
Yeah.
It doesn't feel like it has that distance. It does feel like someone who has made a career distinguishing himself from that, falling into some of those traps where he's like, oh, the audience will get that these guys are good and these are bad. And, you know, we've demarcated these two teams with colors, but all of the bad guys are whatever. Yeah,
exactly. They're Russian. Nobody cares.
Yeah, it does seem so wildly cold to me. And yep. I know that Nolan is not anyone's idea of a warm director, but it does really seem to be, to borrow a phrase from this movie, pissing in the wind of a lot of the things that we like about him, and I think that he would say he likes about himself, frankly. And yeah. I mean, not to speak for somebody, but it does seem like those are a ton of the things that he would choose to reject.
Yeah, no, that is a good point that I didn't think about, but you're right. And I think that sort of wraps up in the whole nameless Bond villain sort of thing where,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's just those are the things about Bond movies that I don't love, you know? I like the big spectacle things. Actually, that's pretty much it. I haven't even come across like a Bond that I really love, like the actor, and I'm including Sean Connery. Yeah. You know, I like Sean Connery better in other stuff. But yeah, no, I see what you're saying, and you're right. And I guess it's time to finally say something good about this movie.
We've said a lot of good things in passing.
No, I know.
We can get to the more the direct version of it. I assume this is you wanted to talk about that hot sauce line, or maybe
definitely.
Where I'm from, they buy you dinner before. Or...
definitely all of the comedy. That's the list of jokes.
The Christopher Nolan comedic fire we've come to know,
like,
and love.
Just don't write jokes. Does he think these things are funny? Like, is he never sat in a room with other people hearing his jokes and not laughing? Like, are there test screenings for The Dark Knight where people are like losing their minds laughing about "I'll take the Benz then, sir," or whatever? Some conversation with Michael Caine. Anyway, let's not get into it. Good things. The thing I love about this movie more than anything, it is not hard to guess. This is the biggest of big swings. You know, like,
yeah.
It is just an unbelievably difficult to understand movie that is so expensive and so exciting and so loud, and maybe the dumbest movie that's ever been made, but it's made by an expert, and I love it so much and could watch it a million times.
Yeah, it's like a home run derby.
Oh, it's so good. Yeah, exactly. It's a home run derby that thinks it's a lecture, maybe, but whatever. I'll take the derby.
It's a home run derby that thinks it's bunting practice. But
I love in David Lynch movies when he messes with, like, as people move in reverse and all that stuff, and just the degree of difficulty in it, just individual scenes in this movie. The first thing they shot in this movie, I'm sure you've discovered this, Nolan likes to talk about this, is that hallway sequence, which if you want to, like, love part of this movie, watch the first time that hallway sequence happens and then immediately jump to the second time that hallway sequence happens. And just, it's so awesome. And it was the first thing they shot, and Nolan's describing how they shot it. It's like, so we did it forwards, and then we're like, okay, now do the whole thing reversed to the actors, to John David Washington and whoever the other stunt person is. And so they have to, like, there's no point in explaining it, but they just do it forwards and then do it in reverse. And it also affects the way that they have to shoot it. And it's shot in Nolan's typical style, which is a very realistic, like, handheld, primarily handheld. And that sort of dissonance is so bizarre. And there are
with fantastic music.
Oh, that's a whole other section.
Piece by piece. Okay. Keep going.
But it's just so impressive, you know? And even, like, there's a moment where when the gold bars are being taken off of the helicopter on Sater's yacht or whatever boat we're on at that point in the boat movie. But when they're just, like, getting off the helicopter with these things, and they're clearly either shot in reverse or are being reversed, and then you just get an edit, and then they're moving forwards. And this happens constantly through the movie, where somebody with one edit is being shot in a totally different way, but they're stitched together in a way that is meant to make them move in one direction, both temporally and, like, physically. And, oh, my God. And then once you see, like, one little thing like that,
you just kind of assume everybody is like that and moving forwards and backwards, and just the mind games that that one thing will play on you for the entire duration of the movie is just awesome. And you cannot give me enough of that.
Yeah. No, I think broadly speaking, that does seem like it is underlined like number one with a bullet of exclamation mark, because it's so good. And then as you said, you'll watch a scene where they're running a stretcher into the fire after the planes landed, and you'll see fire move in a weird way, and it makes
and
you
water.
Recontextual
fire, water, and smoke, like the three things that are impossible to control. Ugh.
Yeah, that you can't do, and you know he didn't do, and then it forces you to reevaluate and recontextualize so much of what's gone on before your eyes. That has to be just the number one takeaway of the degree of difficulty of doing this. And I mean, and you can make it a bit more abstract and apply that to the metaphor of telling a story that does that same thing, which it absolutely does, is go both ways like that. But purely from a visual standpoint, yeah, you can find, and I'm not exaggerating, 100 things on screen that just totally hit that reset button in your mind. Force you, as I said, to look at this in a different way. And that does seem like a preoccupation of Nolan, is the way that two images separated by time, like image A plus image B, comes up with thought C, which is something he got from Eisenstein. But that is like his career preoccupation is making those things substantial to you in a way that other films don't, even though that's so much of the notion of what a visual narrative is, him just approaching it from every angle and then turning that on its head and going in reverse. So yeah, all that stuff, and as I said, without the CGI and with it looking so good and being shot so beautifully, that's the thing that, even for that long list of criticisms we can go through and could fill out even more if we wanted to.
For sure.
you just can't get away from what that feat is.
It's I agree so wholeheartedly. Can't agree any harder. And you mentioned that shot of the gurney when they go back to the Freeport for the second time, or go to the Freeport for the second time.
Let's not get into that.
Yeah, we're saying things incorrectly, but you know what we mean. Don't try to understand it, feel it. You know, like,
that's right.
But that shot where they come out of the shipping container, sorry, the magic shipping container, and they're pushing the gurney. The only like really complex thing that they're doing in that shot is having two people push a gurney backwards, you know, like and then they just shoot it in reverse. Everything else that's happening, it's just extras running around, somebody with a fire hose, there's fire happening. But like, that's a pretty low level stunt, but just flipping it is so goddamn cool, you know, like, and that's like, sort of goes back to what I was saying with that sort of the scale of the opening sequence being deceptively large. That's another deceptively large thing. I know the plane is actually physically large and crashing it is like a real big deal, but that actual shot, which I think is probably the most impressive in the movie, and I know I've pointed out the one of John David Washington doing that slide in the Opera House, but like that, and with the music hit as they're going back into the Freeport, it's just like, and the water hitting Robert Pattinson on the shoulder, just all of that. And that's true of every sequence that plays with time that way. You know, like, it's just so good. And of course, the building exploding two times towards the end is when the red team and blue team both blow it up at the 5-minute mark.
Yeah, see, I can't even do it. Can we put a pin in that one?
Sure. Yes. Does it mean we get to talk about the Freeport more?
Yes.
Okay, then yes.
Yeah, it does.
Pin.
The Freeport of absolute Bond movie fodder. Like, what's a super ballin' way to show off how much art you have but still be a criminal about it? Is that. But like, yeah, it speaks to that wealth inequality stuff that we kind of touched on that I think we want a bit more of. And I think that's one thing that we like about it is that it's there. It's, you know, kind of a season of The Wire. It's super fascinating. And then it's one of the examples in this movie, I think, where you're getting a bit of the Ariadne treatment without it feeling like a slog. Mm-hmm. You know, as he's describing it to Robert Pattinson, you're just like, okay, I'm keeping up with this. I know I'm the outsider here. I'm going to see you play with all of these rules, so I don't mind it. And it's still so visually engaging that I don't mind it the first time through.
Mm-hmm.
And then all that stuff about, well, we use gas instead of water, and you have this much time, and here are the different corridors. Like, that is prime Bond set piece material. Prime action scene material. Not just Bond, but totally fits within that world. And it maybe it's a Robert Pattinson walking around in a nice suit that does some of that heavy lifting. I believe that. But that part feels like a really crisp example of the best kind of this.
Yeah.
And the fight sequences that come of that, and our protagonist getting thrown reverse under that garage door, is perplexing at the time. And then you see it from the other side that it's the jet explosion, is wild. And I think is like, I mentioned that kind of intentionally because I do think it's in a movie full of, you know, examples of reverse physics being interesting. That's one of the ones that I think is like really worth mentioning because the way that it interacts with the actual narrative of the story both times and interacts with your understanding of the, you know, the physics rules at that point of it, I think is like a very, very sharp, you know, microcosm of that.
Yeah, exactly. It's like sometimes something Nolan loves doing is showing you something one time and then showing it to you again and you having a different understanding of it. And he doesn't always like fool you, you know, like in that same sequence, the person that Neil is chasing, and he pulls the helmet off. It's like, okay, cool. So that was definitely the protagonist, you know, like not like, you know, and I'm sure not everybody gets it, but that's on the easier difficulty of guessing, you know, and like when we're introduced to Neil with some backwards music, it's like, okay, cool. So he knows more than what we're being told here for sure. But that sort of seeing him get pulled out of that room again, is the second time is just like textbook. This is like the best of Nolan, you know?
Yeah.
On his greatest hit CD. That'll make the cut for sure.
Yeah, no, I know. And then when you compare it to like even something that's in the same location, as you said, when he's having a fight with himself and is screaming, "Who are you?" and doesn't remove his mask, you're like, okay, so not everything fits so perfectly into these little pockets to make it the most interesting. That's the one that does, though, or that's at least in that category of things that in this area we're allowed to play with those notions. This is it. This is a really fine understanding of how to make that compelling, how to, because as you said, the action sequence is wonderful too, and you're still trying to wrap your mind around what it means to react in a fight to someone who, even if you don't know it's yourself, is still fighting with a different set of physics. That's what you come to a movie like this for, right? That's where your mind is fully engaged with all that explanation you had to sit through. That's where the payoff is.
Yeah.
And so for it to be so sharp like that, I think is valuable. What did you think, this came out, when he's just dropping the gold bars off the plane?
I think I need more specificity. Like, who is he? Is it the protagonist? I think Nolan just thought it looked cool. Is that a bad answer?
No, I don't think it's a bad answer at all, because I think it looks cool. I think it sounds really cool.
Well, and I think the reason that they do it or take that specific plane is because it has gold, and then nobody dies and the gold bars draw attention from anything else that happens, right?
That's
the idea that they have behind it, right?
Yeah, that's their logic. Amish Patel doing a American accent inexplicably in a movie of accents I don't understand says, you know, they'll just think it's terrorism, and then, you know, like he's saying, worst case scenario, if I get caught for this, which I don't think I will, they'll think it's terrorism and I'll go to jail and just kind of get lost in the shuffle in the court system and stuff, which is very loaded about you know, this darker skinned man being assumed terrorism when I don't think any other character would have been thrown into the terrorism bucket, and just this amount of wealth. Like it I think it's notable that Nolan is actually crashing a 747 into a building.
Yeah,
that's what he thought would be cheapest or most interesting. That there is this level of destruction that's okay with a white director under certain terms, and then him playing with that notion on the smaller scale of a, you know, he's just a fixer, I guess, in this movie. But it's, and for a super expensive movie, I think it's wild that there's this visual metaphor of him just dumping buckets of gold bars on the runway for other people. Yeah, you're right. It is always framed as this will distract, you know, EMT or security, and it absolutely would have a function.
It distracts
in that
one of the people that they've hired, you know?
Yeah.
One of those classic Nolan comedy bits takes a gold bar for himself. So I guess I just haven't thought about it. And I do think, given the amount of other over the top stuff about class in this movie, it's, I guess we found something subtle about class that I didn't pick up about class and money. And I think you're right to tie it into the idea that, you know, Nolan pretty famously the story about him being like, well, why can't we blow up a real plane, at once seeing the numbers that it would take to do with miniatures. You're right. Taking it, dropping gold bars out of this symbol of largeness and grandness. And then sort of hearing him talk about the way that the 747 isn't, or whatever kind of plane that is, isn't the size, the symbol of grandness that you think it is, because it's like, well, you know, we take the engine out and put a shittier engine in that we feel comfortable blowing up. We sell the engine, so we save a lot of money there, because that's the expensive part of any plane. And just him breaking it down, and it's just like, okay, yeah, I don't know, this makes sense. Crash that real plane. You know?
Sure.
But also the counterpoint to that is, if you told me that sequence was miniatures, I'd be like, yeah, probably. Looks great. You know, like, that's the appeal of miniatures. If you do them well, then you can't tell. You know, it just matters that they're real things. So to go back to what you're saying about gold bars, I have no thoughts on it. I think it's an interesting thought.
Gotcha. Yeah. Understood. Yeah, it, that's the part of the movie that I think, too, is, I mean, you get it with Sador, too, sort of throughout, but just because it's this world of art and art forgery and free ports, like, that does seem to be the most sort of commercial section of the movie. And it definitely has other motivations and as narrative motivations of moving the plot along, but it's the one where you see, you know, the protagonist wearing a nice suit and holding a cup of tea that he clearly has no interest in, just fitting the visual expectations of wealth in England.
Before the nerds go crazy on the boards, I have to point out it's an espresso.
Sure. Yeah, let's all our tea heads lose their mind.
The IMDb boards are going to be popping off about that one.
No, that does seem like the section that all of that Freeport stuff is the most interested in wealth and the amount of exclusivity and respect that's given you just by being like a nice looking blonde white British person. It does seem the most sort of wrapped up in that idea, and for that to be our for Neil to be our Nolan stand-in, I think is very very important.
Yeah, exactly. And I think just it's a heist sequence too, right? And just by nature of heist movies in general are in some way about class, just inherently stealing from people that have more than you, you know? So it just sort of ties in nicely with the conventions that we're toying with throughout the movie too.
Yeah.
But you are right in that it does deal with class, but in a way that's not annoying. So
no, 100%. I think it flies in quite nicely.
Yeah. So do you want to talk about editing or the score? I have a couple points about each. Nothing too long.
I'd love to hear more about editing because I love a lot of the music in here, but I think that I could learn more for some editing.
So the thing that something that sort of like rubbed me the wrong way about this movie, and this is something that Nolan has been working towards seemingly like on a movie by movie basis, is cutting out as much exposition not exposition because it seems to be adding more in this movie, but the sort of like establishing shots of showing us where we are, right? And first time I saw this movie has no connective tissue, right? He's outside of Priya's apartment building, which incredible action sequence, obviously. And then he's just with Michael Caine, and there's no mention of how he got there. And then he's just in that art dealership talking to Kat. And we do get a little bit of him walking into the room to meet Kat and talking to like a concierge sort of thing. But like, it's 3 seconds long tops. And I really enjoyed the way that as time has gone on and I've watched it more, like I enjoy that those shots don't exist because they're not jarring anymore. And the idea is that like as you get older, the passage of time feels different. And I know I'm kind of paraphrasing Inception when I say this, but like the way you remember events or things that you do, like you don't remember like walking into the room, you know, you remember the conversation that you had in the room, but like opening the door is something that falls out of your memory as fast as it can. And that only becomes more and more true as you get older. And that's also true of how Christopher Nolan is making these movies, right? Like every scene in every movie almost, or like every major Hollywood movie has to start with like, here's the room where we're eating dinner, you know, like a wide shot showing us these things. And certain people like to start on close-ups and work their way back to the wide shot. That's something that I really love about Steven Soderbergh movies, is he starts on close-up almost exclusively and works his way to the wide shot for the very end. And Christopher Nolan's just like, fuck all that noise. We are in the room. I don't care how he gets to the room. I don't care how he gets to the other country. It doesn't matter. And it just makes the whole movie feel more jagged. And it's very Terrence Malick to me, you know? And just sort of like, this is what I want to show. I don't want to show the things that happen in between. I don't care about them. I'm cutting them out entirely and I'm just going with it. And he has always like used Malick influenced stuff for memory moments where you just sort of get these silent cutaways to Leonard Shelby thinking about his wife, or Christian Bale, or sorry, Hugh Jackman in The Prestige thinking about his wife, or Leonardo DiCaprio in Inception thinking about his wife.
Or another man thinking about his wife.
Exactly. I thought of that as I was saying it. But this is something where it just sort of feels more a part of the whole idea, is that we're just cutting out anything that we don't need. And again, like so much of this movie, it doesn't fit with his whole exposition thing. But I just thought that was an interesting idea. And, you know, when we're going to Talon, we're just in Talon. You know, he has that dinner with Kat, has that fight in the kitchen, and then he calls Kat the next day and he's like, we're here. And she's just like, hey, have you ever heard of Freeports? And then boom, we're right into a Freeport montage. And it's just, it's almost funny like how fast it moves, but it is something that I think is really, really interesting and unique, and maybe not the right decision because it is tough to work around. Certainly the first time, but it's, I certainly can get more and more into it the more I watch the movie.
Do you find that do you think that that's, he's not building up these characters and allowing you to put yourself inside them and not being defined by other personal details, or do you think that's just him knowing that his movie's already 2.5 hours.
I think that's part of it. He wants to like cram as much in there as he can. And no, I don't know. I don't know. And like the other thing is, go back to the Malick thing, is he just cast movie stars to play people who have very little detail about them. And we just sort of are meant to bring our own attachment to that person, to Brad Pitt in The Tree of Life, you know, although that's one of the better performances in a Malick movie, more in-depth characters in a Malick movie. But I don't know. I do think it's sort of inspired by Malick and not necessarily learning all of the lessons that you need to learn to make it work. But also, most people I talk to don't think Malick movies work. So that's including the person on the other side of this this conversation. So I don't know. I just it's hard to even explain. It's just something that I find interesting. The things that are easy to explain to me about the editing of this movie are just little small things. Like when we see the protagonist taking apart the gun in the intro and then see him do it again in the Freeport, I think that's a really nice little moment. I guess that's not even an editing thing, but it's just a cool little idea. And the thing, the edit I like maybe the most of any edit in this movie is in that opera sequence, right after he gets the algorithm, he's in that coat check. And then we cut to him like going over a railing back in the performance area. And just the geography of that makes no sense. But you also don't notice it at all unless you're thinking about it. And I just think there's lots of little moments like that in this movie where you just cut out part of the geography, but you don't really notice unless you're looking for it. And maybe you notice this as well when Neil's walking through the Freeport and he hears the score, he sees the fire alarm and the sprinklers, and he sees the thing, and then there's a hit of music. And I like that he's like a little bit ahead of the music and ahead of the timing. And I think that's something that's really cool and very, very Nolan, and very, in comparison to a lot of the Nolan-y things in this movie, it's very subtle. And of course, when Neil jumps off the building, when Priya and the protagonist are talking, that's next level. I love that.
Yeah, and just what you're saying made me think of when he talks about ignorance being our ammunition in this movie. Mm-hmm. And he seems, I don't know, I think so much of these things are very knowledge forward. And I think that it ties in with a lot of the, you know, don't try to understand it, just feel it.
Yeah.
And like in the example you gave of him being ahead of the musical tone like that is very much an example of someone knowing these things. Mm-hmm. And knowledge being an important feature, and a line of dialogue like that putting a lot of the kind of X's and O's and the understanding in the back seat.
Mm-hmm.
I've just been trying to compare these movies to other Nolan ones, and so something like Interstellar, which we've talked about a bit tonight, really takes the notion of love and kind of intellectualizes it. You know, I don't think Nolan's strong suit is making human emotions like accessible to people.
Yeah.
Or
just humans.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Exactly. And so for love and Interstellar to be this thing that was this scientific concept, and a meaningful one, and one that obviously related to Murph and Cooper, and you know, tie them together in this way that science can't quite make sense of. Do you think that this was a science forward movie or a emotion forward movie? Oof. When it's done?
I mean, I guess since I felt no emotion, I think it has to be science. You know,
right?
Right? Like that's the only answer. I think that the emotion I feel is like when I'm pumping my fist to some of this goddamn music. It's so good. Like if we're counting that as an emotion, like I definitely got extremely fired up at different moments of this movie. But if we're talking about like a piece of emotion that stays with me, like something in Inception, you know, it's just, that is just not present in Tenet. I think it's science first for sure.
Okay.
Or whatever Nolan's version of science is. I don't claim to be a science expert in any way, so I don't feel confident. Yeah.
Did you see any other Nolan movies in here?
I mean, it's Interstellar poured through a Dunkirk filter, basically. You know, like it's I see him trying to combine his last two movies, you know?
It's how, like, so
I'm gonna give you a really complex idea, and but I'm gonna try and just beat the shit out of you with it, you know, like with the action sequences. And I think every filmmaker, you can see elements of their previous work in what they're doing. It's pretty rare for somebody to be like so, like, totally opposite of what they've just done. And Nolan especially, I think he comes up with new ideas while making the current ideas, you know?
Yeah, like
he thinks of the next thing while making the current thing, which again is true of pretty much every artist. But yes, is the short answer, but not in the way that something like, I guess I also sort of got that out of my system with Inception, where it's like very obvious that there's a part of each of his previous movies in that movie.
Right.
So I guess that I sort of like worked through that emotionally 10 years ago and didn't need to on this one. So yes and no, like there are definitely things that he's learned. And but I think when I was trying to describe this to people and the things that I didn't like about it, I said it's like he tried to make Interstellar in the style of Dunkirk, in that he tried to tell a story, add some emotion to it, but do it from a purely subjective sort of like very loud, very intense sort of way. And it's just kind of incongruent, you know?
Yeah. Okay. No, that's good.
Yeah. But the thing we can all agree on, the music in this movie is something else. And it's something else in a way that is so experimental. Like it's probably the best action movie score that's ever been made. Like, I know that's a very broad thing to say, but I don't like listen to action movie scores because they're all the same, you know? And this sounds like, I don't even know what this sounds like. There's part of this movie where I was like, oh, that sounds like a Mars Volta thing. And then I listened to the Mars Volta album it reminded me of a couple days later, and it's like, oh, it is the Mars Volta, which is such a weird band to be pulling. And, you know, we get that sort of like traditional guitar hits, but pretty much everything else is like a synth on top of a synth on top of 14 filters. Like, it's just all of it. And I think the opening music piece is like better than any piece that's been in any Nolan movie, for sure. And I'm not like, I think Hans Zimmer and Christopher Nolan have done incredible work together. I think Hans Zimmer's perception by most people is higher than it should be, because outside of what he's done with Nolan, he's not as great as people think he is with Nolan. And I thought the best piece of music I would ever hear in an action movie was in Dunkirk on Supermarine, which is the one that just sounds like sirens and is just 7 minutes long and it's just a nightmare, but so good. And it's Rainy Night in Talent. It's just the best music. It is the best piece of music. And when the synths come in, it is incredible. So,
I think that with Hans Zimmer, and this is, speaks to their collaboration, I think that it is more a inextricable part of the plot. Like watch Inception and you know, I mean, after the fact, but you know, this song slowed down and you know what that means to the characters. That seems to be a different beast than this, whereas you could say, write me 10 pieces of music to fit this, and you know, five of them might be good and two of them might be really, really good. But it seems like there could only be one thing that was in the Inception soundtrack. Mm-hmm. And you know, you can argue about who deserves the credit for that, and there was some, you know, obviously a ton of collaboration for it. And I don't mean that to take anything away from the Ludwig music that's in this, because it is wild and it is so good. And I, when they're about to bungee up and it sounds like a bungee string, like a rope being like tuned up and getting to higher notes, I think is super interesting and a very fascinating combination of studio music and the visuals that are on screen and what you're about to see, and you don't even know really what you're about to see. Yeah.
And you love palindrome music, and that piece of music is a palindrome.
That's true. A ton of goodness there. So I think of it as something separate from some of the Hans Zimmer music, not all of it, some of it. But in isolation inside of a tiny little box, it is some of the most fun music that is in his filmography.
Yes. Oh, for sure. It is so, I so desperately hope that they continue to work together, because just having this level of Ludwig Göransson specifically, the composer, but having this level of experimentation in a type of music that typically does not allow for any, you know, like that's like we've been joking for 10 years now that it's just the bombs, you know, like and most action movies sound kind of the same, even the ones that Hans Zimmer and Christopher Nolan did together, you know, in that they sort of come from the same family, and these two guys just made it better. You know, they made it better than what other people did. And
Symphony is for, like, no, I just mean it's instrumentation choices that have been established in the, I don't know, 1600s, yeah, maybe 1700s.
Yep, for sure. And on like a lot of the Tenet score sounds like it was made by a person alone in a room. And I don't say that dismissively at all. I think to the benefit of the score. And I know there are plenty of musicians playing on it. But it sounds like just an absolutely mad genius just tinkering in their basement for a year and a half. And like, it was the best case scenario is what came out of it. And I say this as somebody who like has, I think Gunnarsson's or Göransson's score work is pretty up and down, but like this movie, oh, the music is so good. So good.
Yeah. And that's my understanding of how much of how he had to make a lot of this music was getting members of an orchestra to send him a piece, like, yeah, said, this is what I want you to play.
Yeah, but even so, like, just the way that, sorry to cut you off, but just even the way that this movie was released, or the way that the prologue was released, and the way that the beginning of so many Nolan movies is released with attached to whatever the big December release is. So like the piece of music in the first 5 minutes of this movie is sort of the alone in a room mad genius sort of sound that I'm describing, and that had to be done like way before anything else. So even with those limitations, I think the idea was still to have it sound something like this, you know. And I think, yeah, I don't think it affected what he planned to do or what they planned to do. I think it just sort of affected how they accomplished it,
you know? Right. Yeah, yeah. Which the product would have been much of the same no matter what the circumstances of the recording.
Exactly, because I know what the idea a person alone in their basement implies, that they're just on full lockdown because of a pandemic.
Yeah.
But that's not what I mean at all. I think it's by design, and I think it's really cool. Yeah.
So do you think that the, like, 5 years down the road, 10 years down the road, assuming anything gets kind of back to normal, do you think this has a bit of an asterisk? Like, do you think that people look at this differently in his filmography because of the incredible circumstances? Or do you think, like, really the production wasn't affected that much?
Production wasn't affected, no.
Yeah, it sounds like they were already editing. So, I mean,
and Nolan famously finishes everything ahead of schedule anyway in post.
Yeah, and I don't mean to be dismissive of the editing process, but it's obviously one of the less collaborative you know, parts of a film. And so it definitely had a big release, definitely had a big impact on how people viewed it, definitely had a big impact of how people I mean literally viewed it, like, you know, butts and seats.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
Walking to a theater, but also just you had a very different understanding of it because the world you've been living in to, you know, almost a year before that is different. How much do you think that just kind of disappears after things change? Or do you think that it's still always going to be bound up in the story, and him talking about, you know, how it was released or how he wanted it to be released is going to be tied up into it? Or is it going to just get lost in the shuffle and, you know, better or for worse?
I don't think I can say. I think it depends on what his next movie is. I think it's dependent on a story that's still, I think, up in the air. I think it's very dependent on HBO Max, this whole HBO Max business, Warner Brothers, because Warner Brothers is Nolan's studio. I think it's dependent on if Christopher Nolan ever makes another movie for Warner Brothers, seeing how long that disagreement goes on for. I think it's totally dependent on, because Warner Brothers has been the filmmaker studio, if Denis Villeneuve is going to make another movie with them, if Patty Jenkins is going to make another movie with them. I just think there's too much still up in the air to really say. And I think it's totally, it will be totally dictated by Nolan's next movie, basically, and also the way that the world moves. But
yeah.
So I don't have an answer because I would just be guessing, and my guess will be wrong no matter what. So I want to sound smart. I want to sound smart by being non-committal and definitely right by saying I don't know.
Super smart.
And nobody can know. The one last thing I do need to point out about this movie,
sure,
and I think it sort of is, it ties up everything I love about it from a visual standpoint, is when the helicopters are flying in for the big battle where 500 people are killed without us caring about it at all.
mm-hmm.
Yeah. When they're all flying in and I think Wheeler is her name. She's like, she's got a shockwave coming, and there's an explosion that sort of rattles these helicopters while they're still in the air. And just in the wide shot, you can see the protagonist and Ives and Neil being, or Neil pulling them out of the hole that they're in that final piece of action. And I just think, like, that's something that is so goddamn cool and so small, and it's just, you have to be looking for it to see it. And there's a lot of that type of thing in this movie. And if there's anything that I love about filmmaking, it is just saying, I want to try this thing, I believe this will work, but saying it out loud sounds absurd. And then you're given hundreds of millions of dollars to do that, and you don't follow, you don't hit it. Like, you don't hit the nail on the head. You don't get everything right. But when you're trying something that absurd and that off the wall, and you get even 50% of it right, like, it is a marvel. And we should celebrate it, you know? And we spent a lot of time talking about what we don't like about this movie, spent a lot of time talking about what we do like about this movie. I know I will watch this movie 15 more times in my life, if not more. And that's great. It's a win, you know? Like, it's not a perfect movie, but he's already made a couple of those, so that's fine.
Yeah.
You know? Or perfect as perfect can be.
No, I agree. And yeah, 100%. And that... when you know that that's something that he's earned from making a lot of odd decisions and a lot of things people didn't have a ton of faith in, probably shouldn't have.
Yeah.
That makes that side of the storytelling always more interesting and just rewarding to see.
Yeah, agree. So yeah, thanks for listening to our Tenet podcast. It's probably about as long as Tenet. And check back next time.